Chapter 5. When people renounce lies, they simply cease to exist. Like parasites, they can only survive when attached to a person. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. A truth that disheartens because it is true is still of far more value than the most stimulating of falsehoods. Maurice Maeterlinck. I'm not quite done with Virtuoso Grumico, who first pops into this story nearly 40 years before a president of the United States finally pronounced the Soviet Empire evil. It was 1944, and Grumico was the new wartime ambassador to Washington, a survivor of the 1930s purges that had decimated Soviet elites. No doubt, Grumico's rapid climb was due to what Conquest would later describe as Stalin requisite, servility and ruthlessness. There he was, the 34-year-old ambassador, likely ensconced in the elegant Soviet embassy, a Beaux-Arts mansion built near the White House by the wife of the American capitalist whose fortune came from Pullman cars, when, on Tuesday, April 4th, 1944, the defection of Viktor Kravchenko sensationally made the front page of the New York Times. Soviet official here resigns, assails double-faced policies. Within the next several years, Kravchenko would write two enduringly significant books on the totalitarian horrors of life in the USSR that prefigure Solzhenitsyn. He would also, in the course of the world-famous libel suit he would bring against a communist publication in Paris, effectively put the Soviet system itself on trial for these same horrors and win. Whether clairvoyance figured into the Soviets' panic, the spare facts of that first news story were threatening enough to the Soviet masquerade as American ally. Kravchenko, for 22 years a Communist Party apparatchik, then an economic attaché at the Soviet headquarters in Washington of the $300 billion pipeline to our wartime allies, known as Lend-Lease, had flown the communist coup. To which, one might ask, say, wasn't that the same Lend-Lease aid program that officially gave first priority to Russian planes, even over planes for U.S. Army Air Forces, as Major George Racy Jordan's January 1, 1943 orders said, and that sent to the Soviet Union those half a million trucks and jeeps that Khrushchev declared in 1970 were indispensable to the Red Army sweep across Eastern Europe, pulling the Iron Curtain down behind them, and the same program that a brainwashed or mind-gaming Mikhail Gorbachev refused even to acknowledge when George Shultz brought it up in 1985? The very same. Now, it's possible that when Gorby first denied Lend-Lease, he didn't know better. He might not have grasped or even have been able to conceive of anything more closely approximating reality than the Soviet propaganda he was raised on. Us, too, come to think of it. Lend-Lease boss Harry Hopkins, FDR's alter ego, co-president, or Rasputin, depending on who's talking, might well have proclaimed in 1942 to Russia, the world, and Madison Square Garden that nothing shall stop us from sharing with you all that we have and are. But there was no audible, credible Soviet acknowledgement of the influx of massive American aid in the Soviet Union during World War II or after. In fact, with those hundreds of thousands of Dodge trucks rolling off the ships with instructions in Russian stenciled in Detroit, there is a sense in which the U.S. government, vassal-like, effectively conspired in its own deprecation. By going along with the ruse, the United States bolstered Stalin's propaganda that the USSR fought the war alone, while simultaneously snowing the American people with happy talk about Stalin to make the case for more, indeed unlimited, aid. American statecraft as Soviet strategy? That's how it strikes me, and Stalin was always in the driver's seat. Is that a German Jeep or an American Jeep? An American correspondent asked at the Russian front in the summer of 1944. Neither one, said the Red Army lieutenant. It's a Russian Jeep. Your American Jeeps are too flimsy. 5,000 kilometers and they fall to pieces. Here, we only use Russian Jeeps. So went the psychological subtext of World War II, a codependence policy of appeasement, based, it was thought, said, and believed, on a tangle of heightened emotions driven by the fear that Stalin would cut a deal with Hitler, and the hope that Stalin was, or would some better day become, our bestest friend. In the war's aftermath, military expert Hanson Baldwin analyzed such delusions in Great Mistakes of the War, a slim, instructive book outlining what the Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent called the four great and false premises of the war. Great, false premises of the war? The good war? The American victory? Baldwin's is an eye-widening, counter-conventional concept. It brought me up short, as I think it probably would anyone raised on the rah-rah narrative of World War II as pure American triumph. Sure, Yalta was a disaster, the Iron Curtain was an epic tragedy, and China went red, but that was all post-war aftermath, Cold War origins stuff. The main event was that Hitler was licked, and the world was safe again for democracy. Or was that safe for people's democracy? On a more gimlet-eyed second glance, the post-war map doesn't look so good, what with the Soviet Union having engorged itself on a European continent divided according to the war-igniting Nazi-Soviet pact, only with the Nazis conveniently excluded, courtesy Allied intervention, which was, when you think of it, quite a generous contribution to the Soviet cause. From Finland to the Baltics to the Balkans, from East Germany, which was permitted to encircle partitioned Berlin, to Poland, whose invasion by Germany and the USSR brought England and France to war in the first place, all was lost to the evil empire. As for Asia, where the Soviet Union declared war on Japan on August 8, 1945, thanks a lot, the Soviets claimed and received Manchuria, which had been promised to the Chinese at Yalta. The Soviets also got Japan's Kuril Islands and half of Korea on a plate. That worked out well. Regarding the globe this way isn't just a glass-half-empty exercise. It is a massive conceptual twist that forces what we know about victory into reverse. Hanson Baldwin's 1949 book provides a good, solid point of analytical departure, particularly given that his four great and false premises of the war all have to do with our incorrect assessments and misperceptions of the Soviet Union, head fakes all, rather than conventional military blunders, as one might expect. They were, number one, that the Soviet Union had abandoned its policy of world revolution. Number two, that Uncle Joe Stalin was a good fellow, someone we could get along with. Number three, that the USSR might make a separate peace with Germany. Number four, that the Soviet Union's entry into the war against Japan was essential to victory or necessary to save thousands of American lives. Such premises, in other words, all fall into the category we would later identify as Soviet desinformatia, disinformation purposefully planted, fed, primed, echoed, and amplified according to Kremlin plan. Accepting Baldwin's list, then, we might consider two possible explanations. We ourselves arrived at these false premises, or we, subverted from within by hundreds of agents loyal to a foreign power and aided and abetted by exponentially more fellow travelers and useful fools, were convinced to arrive at these false premises and were duped. by a massive communist influence operation into making these and many, many other mistakes. This is the shocking new scenario that begins to take shape with the overlay of intelligence history onto diplomatic, military, and cultural history. Circa 1949, the basic evidence of Soviet infiltration of the U.S. government was fresh, hot off the hearings following the 1948 appearances of Elizabeth Bentley and Whitaker Chambers before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. News of such infiltration has no discernible impact on Baldwin's analysis. This could be due to delay built into the publication schedule. It could also be due to the rawness of the evidence, not to mention the intensive controversy it ignited. 60 years later, we have no such excuses. As Haynes, Clare, and Vasiliev point out in their nearly 100-page chapter in Spies on Government Infiltration, the Vasiliev notebooks, copied from KGB archives, confirm that the dozens of officials the two ex-spies named were Soviet sources, while most of these same names also appear in the Venona cables. Remember, Chambers and Bentley, these two greatest network sources, only knew the half of it. This leaves it to us to re-examine the old lore with eyes open to the long-hidden implications of communist penetration at every echelon of the U.S. wartime government. White House, Treasury, State, War, OSS, Office of War Information, and more. We need to walk back over our battlegrounds, pore over old strategies, and ask ourselves whether it is the case that our forebears made honest-to-goodness American mistakes to make the USSR the true victor of World War II, or whether it is possible instead that they became instruments, willingly or not, of long-term Soviet strategy. To make the question concrete for a moment, were all of those hundreds of thousands of Lend-Lease Jeeps and trucks really the awesome output of a sovereign American state acting in its own best interest? Or even a sovereign state of mind thinking about its own survival? Or is there some way in which those trucks symbolize a tithe, a tax, an offering of a serf-like nation? Were they a sweetener or bribe? That's how the 200 million plus pounds of butter Uncle Sam shipped to the USSR looks in light of strict stateside rationing at the time. Such notions may sound outrageous, I know, and I may be asking these questions too soon, before I have marshaled all of the arguments. Nevertheless, it's important to mark the trail through the looking glass early in order to see where we're going. It wasn't just an atmosphere of deception created by agents of Soviet influence that undermined American strength. After the war, Viktor Kravchenko would testify before Congress to the effect that the Soviet Lend-Lease operation he defected from, the Soviet Purchasing Commission, located about 3 miles due north of the front door of the White House, was in reality the Soviet Spying Commission, the Soviet Thieving Commission, and the Soviet Ransacking Commission, with its 1,000-plus employees under orders to filch as many industrial and military secrets as possible for the upcoming struggle between the USSR and the USA. This struggle, they were all told, would inevitably follow World War II. We may have been numb to the chill, but what we call the Cold War was underway long before historians tell us it began. All the signs of struggle were there for anyone to see. Anyone, that is, who could believe his own eyes, who could close his ears to the incessant propaganda. Russian aims were good and noble. Communism had changed its stripes, Hanson Baldwin writes, recapping the stream of wartime hooey. He continues, "A study of Marxian literature and of the speeches and writings of its high apostles, Lenin and Stalin, coupled with the expert knowledge of numerous American specialists, should have convinced an unbiased mind that international communism had not altered its ultimate aim. The wolf had merely donned a sheepskin. Islamic aims are good and noble. What stripes could possibly need changing? Extremists are trying to hijack one of the world's great religions, a religion of peace. A military analyst of the future will write of our own era's propaganda stream. A study of Muhammad's law or Sharia and the speeches and writings of Islam's authorities, Hassan al-Banna and Yusuf al-Qaradawi, coupled with the expert knowledge of American specialists, should have convinced an unbiased mind that international Islam posed a dire threat to liberty. Don't think we aren't penetrated today by new totalitarians who look to Mecca, not Moscow. Baldwin says we became victims of our own propaganda, but what if it's more accurate to say we became victims of Soviet propaganda, as shaped and disseminated by Soviet agents within our Soviet-penetrated government? Above a certain level of infiltration by the other side, a group, a body, or an institution is no longer viably ours. It's theirs. I believe the infiltration of the United States soared past that danger level to the point of de facto occupation, where national interest was no longer paramount, but Soviet interests were. The emperor, in other words, wore Soviet clothes. This is more than a theoretical gambit or flight of fancy. If I have drawn the correct conclusions from what I have assimilated from the gargantuan body of research on view, we must overhaul and revamp our understanding of our historical universe to appreciate the level of infiltration or occupation I am talking about. Let's take the Office of War Information, one of those government bureaus set up in the early stages of the war. The OWI's mission called for pro-American and pro-Allied propaganda at home and abroad, but it tended to push communistic policy at home and the Soviet line abroad. Or, to quote the more peppery 1954 description by Chesley Manley, longtime Washington correspondent of the Chicago Tribune, a bitterly anti-Roosevelt paper in those days, OWI was loaded with draft dodgers, red revolutionists, and a scum of European refugees who pretended to sell America to the world, but made it their business to sell communist Russia to America. Periodically, OWI drew the equivalent of dirty looks from congressional Republicans and even censure once from FDR himself for an outbreak of Sovietophilia beyond even White House bounds. As M. Stanton Evans writes, having scrambled to recruit personnel numbering in the thousands, with little time and apparently less desire for anti-red security vetting, units such as OWI were custom-built for penetration. They worked like a dream. Soviet dream, American nightmare. That's a lot to accept on faith, I know. So here follows a sampling, extracted from several volumes of spy tracking research by our leading scholars, of OWI personnel under OWI directors Robert Sherwood, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and Harry Hopkins' crony and biographer, and Elmer Davis, a popular pre-Cronkite radio commentator whose tenure is aptly summed up by his yeoman efforts to cover up Soviet responsibility for the Katyn Forest Massacre, setting the story for domestic broadcasts which would bar commentators who spoke the truth about Soviet guilt. There was Joseph F. Barnes, OWI Assistant Director of Overseas Reporting. For starters, Barnes was an alumnus of the 1933 Moscow Correspondents' Conspiracy to suppress news of the terror famine and the takedown of Gareth Jones, described in the last chapter. According to Rammerstein and Brindell, Barnes had a long relationship with Soviet intelligence. In the fall of 1944, a Venona cable mentions Barnes, noting that while recruiting him for the NKVD is obviously not only inadvisable but unrealizable, it is desirable to use him without signing him up. One explanation for this, Rammerstein and Brindell posit, may be that he was already working for the GRU, or Soviet military intelligence. In open congressional hearings in 1951, four witnesses would identify Barnes as a communist, including ex-communists Whitaker Chambers and Louis Budenz, and former Soviet intel officer Alexander Barmin. There was Owen Lattimore, the ardently pro-communist director of OWI's Pacific operations. Lattimore's status as a spy remains contested, although not for want of expert opinion. Chiang Kai-shek conveyed to the FBI in 1948 that he believed Lattimore, while acting as his Roosevelt-supplied wartime advisor, was supplying information to communist forces, and Alexander Barmin knew of Lattimore as a Soviet agent. Meanwhile, his function as an agent of communist influence is impossible to contest. Lattimore would be described in 1952 by Senator Pat McCarran's Internal Security Subcommittee as a conscious, articulate agent of the Soviet conspiracy. Having studied his recently declassified FBI files, M. Stanton Evans reports that Lattimore spent an inordinate amount of time swimming in a veritable red sea of officially communist spies and Moscow agents. Not surprisingly, his files are replete with data about his links to communists and Soviet agents, allegations that he stacked his Pacific office of OWI with pro-Red staffers, that he belonged to communist fronts, that his writings were pro-Soviet propaganda. Barmin would testify publicly that Soviet intelligence regarded both Barnes and Lattimore as our men. Barnes would later help Lattimore write Ordeal by Slander, his 1950 counterattack on Joseph McCarthy, which popularized the epochal term, likely published first in the Daily Worker, McCarthyism. There was David Carr, formerly of the Daily Worker, who served in OWI as a foreign language specialist. Long suspected of being a Soviet agent, Martin Dies brought him before his committee in 1943, where Carr pleaded innocent lamdom and falsely claimed to have been working for the FBI all along. Carr resigned from this government job to serve as a legman and reporter to Drew Pearson, the leading anti-communist columnist of the mid-20th century, and, later, the central figure for mobilizing attacks on McCarthy in the Washington Press Corps. Later denounced as an agent working on behalf of Moscow in what M. Stanton Evans describes as one of McCarthy's bitterest speeches in 1950. Carr was roundly defended from all charges, including by another senator. If Carr was pro-communist, Pearson replied in the New York Times, the Washington Monument is a hole in the ground. Well, Carr was, appearing both in Venona as a source and in Soviet archives as a confirmed agent. And the Washington Monument isn't. As Evans concludes, all of this indicates McCarthy knew whereof he spoke. There was Cedric Belfridge, an alumnus of both British and U.S. intelligence, who, as a member of OWI's denazification team, drew McCarthy's notice, correctly, for work on behalf of U.S.-funded communist publications. Portrayed as a hapless victim of McCarthyite excess when he took the Fifth Amendment, rather than answer whether he had been a communist, Belfridge, as Evans reports, was in truth a KGB agent who appears in numerous Venona cables reporting back to Moscow with highly sensitive information from the office of British spy chief William Stevenson, the man Churchill called intrepid. Haynes, Clare, and Vasiliev further describe him as fanatically devoted to Chinese communism. There was journalist James Aronson, Belfridge's OWI sidekick in communistification as denazification and other ventures, who later took the Fifth Amendment when asked about membership in the Communist Party. There was Julia Older Baeser, who handled OWI's cable file to Moscow, who also invoked the Fifth Amendment on being asked about party membership. Baeser, Evan notes, was the sister of columnist Drew Pearson's legman, Andrew Older, ID'd by the FBI as a communist agent. There was journalist Peter Rhodes, unambiguously a KGB agent, Haynes, Clare, and Vasiliev Wright, who, according to an October 1941 KGB memo, has been hired for a government job and is traveling to London as head of the information office, which will supply information to the president, Donovan, the Second Department or Army Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, and the FBI. The memo continues, Peter has been given the right to hire employees for the aforementioned office. This is a pretty good find for us. Rhodes, later identified by Elizabeth Bentley as a member of the Golos Network, would become chief of the Atlantic News section. There was labor correspondent Travis Hedrick, who would leave OWI to what you might call graduate to the Soviet government news agency TASS and take the Fifth Amendment when asked if he had been a Communist Party member. There was Robin Kincaid, an OWI analyst of foreign propaganda, who the FBI reported in 1944 was a contact of Gregory Kafitz, whom Rommerstein and Brindell ID'd as NKVD resident in San Francisco and active in atomic espionage. There was William Hinton, sent by OWI to assist Chiang Kai-shek and allied forces in China, who would also take the Fifth Amendment when asked by Congress if he was a party member and would later return to China to work for Mao's revolution. There was Paul Hagen, a leading light on the OWI German desk. Hagen was a member of the Communist Party in his native Germany and later identified by the FBI as a Soviet agent, active in Communist Front organizations in the United States. Presidential aide Lachlan Curry appeared as a sponsor for a visa application of Hagen's. Sounds crazy until you find out Curry, too, was a bona fide Soviet mole. A 1943 Venona cable further identified Hagen as close to Eleanor Roosevelt, part of the coterie of communists and collaborators she allowed herself to be surrounded by. Louis Adamek, an informal guru on the Yugoslav desk, pushed the pro-Tito communist propaganda campaign that destroyed the reputation of the genuinely anti-Nazi, anti-Red, Serbian leader General Draha Mihailović, helping to convince the Allies that Mihailović was a collaborator and traitor. Mihailović's isolation and later execution by Tito marks one of the most notorious Soviet deception campaigns and Allied disgraces. Carlo Aprato was on the OWI Italian desk. His resume included being expelled from Switzerland for life as a Soviet agent who received and dispersed funds from Moscow. Haynes and Clare further note that after the war, several members of OWI's Polish language section emerged as defenders of the communist takeover in Poland and as close relatives of officials in the new Polish communist regime. For example, Arthur Salmon would graduate from OWI's Polish desk to become editor-in-chief of Robotnik, or Worker, a big paper in communist Warsaw. Flora Wovshin was an almost frantically active KGB agent within OWI. Her Soviet intelligence activities there and later at the State Department take up some 20 Venona cables. Irving Lerner, an employee of OWI's motion picture division, was caught red-handed trying to photograph the cyclotron used in the creation of plutonium at Cal Berkeley. Speaking of the OWI's motion picture division, along with the White House, it was deeply involved in the making of Mission to Moscow in 1943, summed up by producer Robert Buckner as that expedient lie for political purposes. The question is, whose political purposes? Ours or the Soviets? Kenneth Lloyd Billingsley notes, Mission to Moscow was known as the first Soviet production from a major American studio. That was originally meant ironically, but it is very nearly literally true. Remember, the thing was written by Moscow Show Trials super apologist Joseph Davies, who would be praised also in 1943, by Soviet ambassador to the United States, Maxim Litvinov, as, in effect, an envoy of the Soviet Union in Washington. Naturally, the first in effect Soviet envoy in Washington would make the first in effect Soviet production in Hollywood. As the old Soviet socialist realist said, the only task of literature was that of fulfilling the social directions of Stalin. Mission to Moscow succeeded. What of poor Kravchenko, dangling in the limbo of defection for the past 8 pages? He too figures into the story of OWI penetration. Kristina Kratkova, an NKVD agent who insidiously became Kravchenko's typist, translator, and KGB informant, was also on Uncle Sam's payroll as an OWI employee. Still, the dossier is incomplete. Haynes and Clare, for example, point out that not all Soviet intelligence assets inside OWI and codenamed in Venona have even been identified. It's not the biggest leap of logic to see that this Office of War Information could well have been named the Office of Soviet War Information. Suddenly, Chesley Manley's wild talk of Red Revolutionists and scum of Europe becomes merely descriptive, almost humdrum. It's that official U.S. government stamp of approval, the perfect cover, that suddenly seems lurid, dangerous, and confounding. Back along the Lend-Lease supply line, thousands of miles west of OWI and Kravchenko's post in Washington, D.C., U.S. Army Major George Racy Jordan, a Lend-Lease expediter, found himself thinking along similar lines in the months before Kravchenko's defection. Having bought the United Nations propaganda, at least for the duration, Jordan was nonetheless perplexed by what he saw going down the Lend-Lease supply line, what he himself, as an expediter, had orders to speed along. Even with Uncle Sam's sanction, the increasing amounts of secret cargo bound for the Soviet Union under protection of diplomatic immunity bothered him more and more, finally kicking him into the kind of action that transformed this everyday, unsuspecting patriot, a businessman in his 40s who had flown with Eddie Rickenbacker in the First World War, into one of our rare fellow citizens, a rare human being, who takes a step out of line, who says no to the machine, who loves his country more than its establishment, ultimately ascending to what ex-socialist Max Eastman once called the moral aristocracy. Jordan's official role was to expedite the air transport of thousands of tons of cargo and hundreds of U.S. warplanes, first out of Newark, New Jersey, and later out of Gore Field, the big wartime airbase in Great Falls, Montana. He may have been officially on the outside looking in, but as liaison officer to the Soviet Lend-Lease representatives, Jordan found himself in quarters so uniquely close, he was practically expediting Lend-Lease en famille. For instance, once, when Jordan stopped by the apartment of the Soviet chief, Colonel Anatol Kotikov, and his wife's secretary to drive the pair to work, already kind of cozy, he saw Mrs. Kotikov pull her husband's treasured experimental chemicals dossier, the one the Russian official brought back and forth to work every day, from a hiding place under the mattress while her husband was pulling on his handsome boots of black leather. All very homey, but what was in that file? Turns out it had to do with everything you need, courtesy Lend-Lease, to cook up a brand new and experimental atomic pile. Jordan got along well with Colonel Kotikov. They worked at desks side by side, but not so well that he didn't smell a Lend-Lease rat. A lot of them, in fact, all skittering through Great Falls under diplomatic immunity to Russia. It wasn't diplomatic pouches that were going through. These questionable cargoes usually shipped in large, cheap, shiny black suitcases, sealed with red wax and bound with white cord. What came out later was that back in Washington, D.C., Viktor Kravchenko himself helped to pack up some of these very suitcases Jordan saw moving down the pipeline. Of course, pipeline doesn't do the supply effort justice. It was more like a vacuum cleaner. Jordan argues that Lend-Lease was the greatest mail order catalog ever, and he proves it in his 1952 book, From Major Jordan's Diaries, a precious memoir of life along the Lend-Lease pipeline. The book contains the most complete lists of Soviet Lend-Lease materiel ever published, I do believe, to this day. There was that nearly million miles of copper wire that lay coiled in spools in Westchester County for post-war Russian use, but at a higher priority under Lend-Lease than refitting war-damaged U.S. Navy ships mentioned in Chapter 2, along with other sundries, the oil refinery, the hydroelectric plants, the pianos. The list goes on. Railway car axles without wheels, 69,818,310 pounds, $2,520,778. Railway car axles with wheels, 49,900,258 pounds, $2,392,165. Power metal working machine tools, 5,773 pounds, $6,461,539. Power machines, tools, and parts, $60,313,833. In tiny type like this for 25 pages. One entry that stopped me cold, in between three electric fans for $33 and, lucky Politburo wives, 204 electric domestic vacuum cleaners for $6,752, was an entry for more than $6 million worth of searchlights and airport beacons and floodlights. Imagine, when a slave prisoner of the Gulag made a midnight break for the Arctic tundra, Soviet jailers zapped his cover of darkness with a searchlight made in the USA. Jordan's list includes more than $13 million worth of aluminum tubes, necessary for cooking uranium into plutonium, over 800,000 pounds of cadmium metal, which is necessary for controlling the intensity of an atomic pile, over 13,000 pounds of thorium in 1942, and other ingredients for an atomic pile. Almost 12,000 pounds of thorium shipped out in January 1943, Jordan notes, but none thereafter, due undoubtedly to General Groves' vigilance, Jordan writes. Jordan was referring to General Leslie Groves, the chief of the Manhattan Project. Groves would later testify before Congress in 1949 that his operation came under continuous pressure to release experimental atomic materials to the USSR from the Lend-Lease office. If George Racy Jordan is remembered at all, If Jordan were to be remembered at all, it would be for the compilation of reports, orders, journal entries, and jottings on envelopes that Jordan compiled between May 1942 and June 1944 that comprise a unique record of the Lend-Lease experience, of what, in effect, was the national looting far above and beyond the exigencies of war supply that the U.S. government enabled on behalf of the USSR during and even for some time after World War II. Not that the United States didn't receive something in return. After Jordan took on the role of Great Falls de facto immigration official, he recorded the names, ranks, and functions of some 418 Russians who deplaned and illegally entered the United States. The list proved to be of value, I was told, in tracing communist espionage in America during the war, he wrote in his 1952 book. Jordan couldn't do much with the nameless Russians he watched land in Great Falls and make a run for it, just as though they knew where they were going, Jordan always thought. I would see them jump off planes, hop over fences, and run for taxicabs. It was an ideal setup for planting spies in this country. Quite a contrast to Americans who made anything like an unauthorized landing in the Soviet Union. I'm thinking of one crew from the famous Doolittle raid who, after their stunning bombing run over Tokyo, on April 18, 1942, landed their B-25 at a Red Army Air Force base in Vladivostok. Dangerously low on fuel, having had to launch prematurely from the USS Hornet after the aircraft carrier had been sighted by a Japanese fishing craft, this crew, under Captain Edward J. York, hoped to refuel and continue on to their designated Chinese base to reunite with the rest of the raiders as planned. For the next miserable year, this American crew was interned by the Soviet government. Wait, the Russians were our allies. We were in this together, weren't we? It had to be that way, the Soviets explained, for fear of provoking an international incident with Japan, with whom the Soviet Union was not at war, despite having secretly destroyed the Japanese Sixth Army in Mongolia in August 1939. Notice how the Soviets had no fear of provoking an international incident with the USA, or even causing a hiccup in Lend-Lease, by holding our own men prisoner. As for the lost raiders, York and his crew, suffering from malnutrition and dysentery, ended up working as day laborers in South Russia, where they lived in mud huts on a diet of black bread and cabbage. Eventually, they were able to make a harrowing escape into Soviet-occupied Iran, where their ultimate path to freedom would lie through the British consulate in Mashhad. This is an unseen dark side of the good war, something discarded from our recollections. To be sure, it is not hinted at in 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, the stirring 1944 movie, screenplay by Red Blacklister Dalton Trumbo, based on the memoir of the April 1942 Doolittle Raid by Captain Ted W. Lawson. Enthralled moviegoers who watch Lawson's crew execute the attack on Tokyo, depicted with fascinating documentary footage of the raid, and crash land in China, saw Chinese allies tend to the crew's injuries and transport them beyond the reach of conquering Japanese forces, even as, in reality, their brother bombers lay rotting in Soviet custody, as our Navy was sustaining terrible losses, convoying Lend-Lease materiel to the Soviet Union through U-boat-thick North Atlantic waters, as our own army lay besieged in the Pacific, deprived of desperately needed supplies. And, don't forget, as Jordan began compiling his curious record of Lend-Lease. This included notes on cargo and personnel, which and whom Jordan saw with his own eyes, evidence we must now weigh carefully against his credibility as a witness. After all, he is the only person we know of taking Russian passenger names or spot-checking the contents of those black suitcases, which, at a certain point, started shipping through the airfield 50 at a time and under armed Russian guard. The mystery of these suitcases particularly troubled Jordan, even in this insistently halcyon era of official, no questions asked, and that's an order, amity between the United States and the USSR. Jordan repeatedly raised hell about them, as one senior officer put it. He could get no rise from above. It drove him a little nuts. One midwinter night, Jordan writes, he slipped away from a vodka party in town, hosted by his Russian comrades, the only such party ever staged, and raced the 4 miles back to the airport, where, as he suspected, a Lend-Lease plane was warming up, clearance pending. Jordan pushed and ducked his way past a barrel-chested Russian, as he wrote, one of two armed couriers aboard, to clamber into the plane's cabin. It was dimly lighted by a solitary electric bulb in the dome. Faintly visible was an expanse of black suitcases with white ropes and seals of crimson wax. My first thought was, another bunch of those damn things. The second was that if I were ever going to open them up, it was now or never. As Jordan made his intentions clear, he and the guards began to scuffle. The Russians shrieking, probably the one English word they knew. Diplomatique! Jordan pulled out a safety razor, yanked one of the suitcases into his hands, and began to open it. Quite suddenly, he realized he needed an American witness, and quick, to prevent what he imagined might be passed off as a deplorable accident. I called to a Yank soldier who was on patrol 30 feet away. He crunched over through the snow. Bending down from the plane, I asked him if he had had combat experience. He answered that he had in the South Pacific. I stooped lower and murmured, "I'm going to open more of this baggage. I want you to watch these two Russians. Both are armed. I don't expect any trouble, but if one of them aims a gun at me, I want you to let him have it first. Understand?" After a moment's thought, he looked me in the eye and he said, "Sir, is that an order?" I replied that it was an order. In the frigid black night, Jordan, gloveless, using a flashlight, proceeded to examine roughly every third suitcase. Using one knee as a desk, I jotted notes with a pencil on two long envelopes that happened to be in my pocket. There was usually one entry, or phrase of description, for each suitcase inspected. These scrawls were gathered into a memorandum. What a memorandum it was! It listed the road maps Jordan found pinpointing American industrial sites. Westinghouse, Blaw Knox, maps of the Panama Canal Zone, documents related to the Aberdeen Proving Ground, one of the most sensitive areas in the war effort, folders stuffed with naval and shipping intelligence, stacks of papers on oil refineries, machine tools, steel foundries, and the like, groups of documents on stationery from the Department of Agriculture, Commerce, and State, trimmed close to the text Jordan noted, perhaps to save weight, or remove secret or restricted stamps, or both. Folders from the State Department Jordan claimed were marked "from Serre," that would be Francis Serre who hired Alger Hiss, and "from Hiss," Soviet spy Alger Hiss himself. Engineering and scientific treatises that bristled with formulae, calculations, and professional jargon. Something very, very interesting I will describe a little farther down, attached to a thick map bearing the legend that Jordan recorded as Oak Ridge, Manhattan Engineering District. Remember, this was all taking place sometime in the winter of 1943 to 44, before the invention or public knowledge of the atomic bomb. He also found a carbon copy of a report from Oak Ridge, containing a series of outlandish words Jordan made a note to look up later. Cyclotron, proton, deuteron. There were also curious phrases, he wrote. Energy produced by fission and walls 5 feet thick of lead and water to control flying neutrons. Then Jordan writes, "For the first time in my life, I met the word uranium." Why, in all of our inherited historical legacy, has there been no room for this wartime witness to the plunder of atomic secrets, just as they were being spirited out of the country on a U.S. government-sponsored flight? Not that Jordan understood at the time that this was what was going on. He did, however, have that gut-checking hunch that these documents, so many of them obviously classified, including, for example, confidential reports to the Secretary of State originating in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, shouldn't be heading out of the country to a foreign power. Jordan didn't know it, but he was witnessing the last days of the pre-atomic age, when the Manhattan Project was the biggest state secret the United States had, or thought it had. As we now know, Stalin was not at all surprised when Truman informed him of the atomic bomb at Potsdam in 1945. Turns out, Russian knowledge of the effort was surprisingly widespread. Noted war correspondent W. L. White wrote of a 1944 exchange he had with a Soviet guide who specifically referenced cyclotrons, splitting of atom, and the Manhattan Project in casual conversation. White didn't know what he was talking about and put his misunderstanding down to the language barrier. Knowing that the communist regime controlled its press, it's easy to understand how even 500,000 made-in-Detroit Dodge trucks might disappear from Soviet memory. But by what mechanism did Jordan and his sensational findings completely vanish from U.S. consciousness? Then again, was what Jordan said legit? Was he crazy? Was any of this for real? Here was my next step. To determine whether Jordan's claims were ever proven or disproven, whether he himself had been vetted as a witness. As I had learned, conventional history books would be inadequate, barely hit and mostly miss. Relevant chronicles mainly overlook Jordan's evidence altogether, despite the significant attention, both media and political, that his charges drew at the time. Indeed, it turned out his claims, which originally aired over a national radio broadcast, were subject to thorough FBI investigation and congressional questioning under oath. In those cases where posterity does record Jordan's contributions at all, however, they are almost invariably smeared or discounted. For example, George C. Herring's Aid to Russia, 1941 to 1946, a 1973 study I have found otherwise useful, had this to say. In 1949, one disgruntled former Lend-Lease official even issued sensational accusations that Roosevelt and his pro-communist advisors had given the Russians the raw materials and technical information necessary to produce an atomic bomb. Herring goes on to identify Jordan as the disgruntled official in his endnotes. He continues, "Congressional investigations proved these most extreme charges without foundation." Really? I quote from the March 3, 1950 testimony of Donald T. Apple, former FBI agent and investigator for the House Committee on Un-American Activities, specifically concerning Jordan's charges regarding the Lend-Lease shipment of atomic materials to the Soviet Union. "As to the shipment of uranium and heavy water, two specific shipments of uranium oxide and nitrate and shipments of heavy water have been completely documented, to include even the number of the planes that flew the uranium and heavy water out of Great Falls." Apple testified to further corroboration on 4 out of 5 Jordan claims at issue in these hearings. The fifth, to be discussed below, stands unconfirmed but not by any means ruled out. Clearly, Jordan has vaulted the initial threshold of credibility, prompting the question, what happened to this man in the historical record? What are the implications of his claims? What does it mean for the historical record that his claims, his testimony, almost without exception, have receded into, at best, anonymous limbo? The fate of Jordan's testimony might seem like a small thing, but it shows in a defined and demonstrable example how it is that waves of misinformation wash away the facts, leaving behind a false trail and debris of doubt. We went from completely documented atomic-related transfer in 1950 to disgruntled official in 1972. By 2004, in Albert Weeks' Russia's Lifesaver, Lend-Lease Aid to the USSR in World War II, a book drawing on Russian revisionism, i.e., newly available archival material in Russia, attesting to the existence of vital American Lend-Lease Aid, Jordan's evidence of atomic aid had evanesced into unverifiable myth. In between come the obliterating layers of disinformation. It began, first, with what Jordan described in the preface to his 1952 book as the efforts of the character assassins and the press experts to keep the implications of this story from being brought into proper focus. I put that last bit in italics in the book. I may be a sucker for italics, but this point about implications, Jordan's word in this case, not mine, is so important to the progression of our mortal illness as a civilization, non-judgmentalism regarding mortal threats, that I have to flag it. The efforts to keep implications from coming into relevant focus is the story of our lives. The assassination attempts on Jordan's character, for example, spurious allegations that he was being paid by the GOP, began right after the first public airing of his story on Fulton Lewis's radio show on December 2, 1949. This was just a couple of months after President Truman announced on September 23, 1949, that the Soviets had exploded an atomic bomb. The president's announcement, Jordan wrote, left him shocked and stunned to the depths of my being and made him realize that he personally must have expedited the transfer of key parts of the Soviet atomic program. He had to do something. There was evidence in my possession, I was convinced, he wrote, proving that the disaster was chargeable, not only to spies, but to actual members of the federal hierarchy. Soon, Jordan was able to bring his story to the attention of Senator Stiles Bridges, Republican of New Hampshire, and Lewis, a popular national radio personality. Lewis's staff investigated the story, after which Lewis broke it on the air. FBI investigators methodically, exhaustively, vetted the same charges. This was a far cry from the dead-end apathy that greeted Jordan back in 1944 when he attempted to alert his superiors in Washington to his suspicions. A few days after the radio broadcast, Jordan would testify before the Un-American Activities Committee, returning to testify a second time in 1950. Question. In light of the evidence Jordan provided, which has been corroborated, is it possible to continue to regard the creation of the Soviet atomic bomb as solely resulting from the thievery associated with known KGB-directed espionage rings? Jordan's evidence proves there was more to the story, that the U.S. government itself, via Lend-Lease, played a key role outside the criminal channels we know about. Or was the U.S. government acting inside criminal channels, too? That is, just because Lend-Lease, in effect, said everything was all right, even as Lend-Leased cogs Jordan and Kravchenko knew what was going on wasn't all right, was the Lend-Lease atomic flow indeed all right, kosher, and above board from the point of view and national interest of Uncle Sam? Or was Lend-Lease covering up a rogue operation? Was Lend-Lease, as run out of the White House by the president's top advisor, Harry Hopkins, itself a rogue operation? Before attempting to answer these questions, there is more recent confirmation of George Racy Jordan's credibility to cite. In his 1995 book, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Rhodes mines Jordan's memoir as a reference, reproducing Jordan's list of 23 atomic materials, including nearly 14 million pounds of aluminum tubes, as extracted from Lend-Lease tallies the Soviets gave Jordan. Rhodes describes these ingredients as useful in constructing and controlling a nuclear reactor. He also relates Jordan's eyewitness account of the illegal entry into the country of all those undocumented Soviet espionage workers spilling out of Lend-Lease planes arriving from Moscow and into surrounding Montana. Citing corroborating evidence from a retired general, he even reprises the highly cinematic action sequence Jordan recounted that leads up to Jordan's single-handed assault on the black suitcases, which I included above. Rhodes also quotes, as Jordan himself does, from the dramatic testimony of Viktor Kravchenko, who, in 1950, told the Un-American Activities Committee that he helped pack some of the very suitcases George Racy Jordan saw moving down the Lend-Lease pipeline to the USSR. This was a key piece of the puzzle. Kravchenko recalled working behind closed doors at the Soviet Purchasing Commission in Northwest Washington with communist colleagues, including Semen Vasilenko, an expert metallurgist who was in charge of pipe and tube production in the Soviet Union. Vasilenko, according to Kravchenko, was in the United States for the sole purpose of finding some special information. As Jordan would explain parenthetically, the gaseous diffusion plant at Oak Ridge and the Hanford Plutonium Works use many miles of pipes, hence those millions of pounds of aluminum tubes. Kravchenko recalled helping Vasilenko pack six suitcases filled with assorted industrial plans, found in an unofficial way, as Kravchenko put it. Jordan's diary offered independent evidence that Vasilenko had transited through Great Falls with some 4,000 pounds of diplomatic mail. In his sworn testimony, Kravchenko dated Vasilenko's trip back to Russia to February 1944, the same time frame noted in Jordan's diary entry. Jordan further reported that while in Great Falls, Vasilenko also picked up for transit to Moscow Colonel Kotikov's dossiers, including his treasured experimental chemicals folder. Rhodes writes, Jordan's story of Soviet espionage shipments through Great Falls has never been corroborated in its entirety, but enough pieces of it have found independent confirmation to establish its general credibility. The Rhodes citations mark a crucial step in what should be Jordan's rehabilitation, or rather initial inclusion, as an important historical source. Why not? Meanwhile, it's worth noting that Rhodes, a noted historian of the nuclear age, happens also to be a laurel-crowned establishment figure, a visiting scholar at Harvard and MIT, a PBS host and correspondent, and a recipient not just of the Pulitzer Prize, but of grants from the Ford, Guggenheim, and MacArthur Foundations. In other words, this is no McCarthyite anti-communist vouching for Jordan from the loneliest corners of the right. Rhodes further underscores Jordan's veracity in an additional note on his sources, writing, George Racy Jordan's account of wholesale espionage shipments through Great Falls under cover of Lend-Lease was widely discounted when it first appeared. Widely discounted in the echo chamber of the left, that is. Rhodes continues, I discuss its several corroborations in my text. Based on those corroborations, it appears to me to be largely credible. Soviet espionage was indeed wholesale, and obviously successful. Jordan's black suitcases explain how the 10,000 pages of secret documents that shocked Yakov Terletzky might have been transported. Rhodes is referring to the post-war moment when Terletzky, a young KGB physicist engaged in the Soviet Atomic Espionage Department, was amazed to find 10,000 pages of mainly American and some British top-secret nuclear documents in Lubyanka, KGB headquarters. According to Terletzky, this voluminous catch, which seemed to have materialized from nowhere, outlined the content of the basic experiments in determining the parameters of nuclear reactions, reactors, and the descriptions of various uranium reactors, the descriptions of gaseous diffusion installations, journal entries on the testing of the atomic bomb, and so on. In sum, what can be confirmed in Jordan's testimony has been confirmed, or, in the case of Terlecki's archive surprise, supported. It was not knocked down. It was not poked full of holes. It is still standing, still relevant, even after all these years. Jordan was one hell of a witness. Remember that. It's now April 4th, 1944. Viktor Kravchenko is on the front page of the New York Times, and Virtuoso Gromyko is choking on his morning kasha. Kravchenko said he had resigned to alert America to the fact that Uncle Joe Stalin was playing a double-faced game, talking democracy abroad while practicing totalitarianism at home, and planning to bring it to Europe. Jordan may have been thwarted by his own chain of command. I returned to Great Falls in low spirits, he writes, after an unsuccessful trip in January 1944 to blow the whistle in Washington. But Kravchenko had gone straight to the American public. This set off alarms in official Soviet circles. David J. Dallin, an ex-Menshevik leader and Russian emigre and scholar who helped Kravchenko make his break, describes the panic. We soon learned that in Kravchenko's division of the Purchasing Commission, all work ceased on that Tuesday. People raced in and out. Small conferences were held. Telephone calls about the traitor went on incessantly. Everyone was excited and presumably indignant. I think it's safe to assume that at least some of the time, maybe even incessantly, it was Gromyko on the line. The 34-year-old ambassador would spend much of the following year, the final year of World War II, repeatedly prodding FDR's State Department, personally lobbying the State Department, to deport deserter Kravchenko to the Soviet Union and absolutely certain death. The one thing that wasn't virtuoso about this early Gromyko performance was that it didn't work. If Kravchenko remained free, though, it was not for want of teamwork. Venona cables reveal that in addition to Gromyko's high-level diplomatic efforts, NKVD chief Lavrenty Beria took personal control of the case. Various NKVD agents, including the OWI employee mentioned above, successfully penetrated Kravchenko's circles in and around New York City. Mark Zborowski, a KGB agent who gained admittance to the Kravchenko sanctum, it came out later, had previously infiltrated Trotsky's circles and was involved in the apparent assassination of Trotsky's son in Paris in 1938. Mainly, though, the Soviet stooges watched and harassed, uncertain what else could be done with or to Kravchenko in America, while they awaited his return to Soviet clutches. What we have here is an extensive, foreign, secret police network operating in our midst, a most deadly franchise, as the corpses of defector Walter Krivitsky, Danish diplomat Paul Bang Jensen, and others proved, with branch offices in Washington, New York, Chicago, and Connecticut. No such network of trusted American emigres, refugees, and well-placed moles was similarly set up in Moscow, Leningrad, and the Ukraine to inform, to terrorize, to assassinate defecting Americans and their allies gone rogue. Nor were there agents of American influence at the highest levels of the Kremlin influencing Stalin. It was not the USSR that was occupied by a secret army. It was the USA. Question: who led that secret army? Who cheered it on? Or, more immediately ascertainable, who, in this salient and instructive case, made common cause with the NKVD on the return of Kravchenko, this one lone truth-teller who, prodded by an impulse stronger than survival, more cryptic than uncracked genetic code, was determined, at the risk of life and limb, to bear public witness to Stalin's deception? Answer, the highest, most powerful official to make common cause with the NKVD on Kravchenko's defection was Harry Hopkins. He was also Roosevelt's most intimate and ubiquitous advisor. He was also, as well noted at the time, America's co-president, who, not at all incidentally, in another acid rinse of the historical record, barely surfaces in our cultural consciousness today, as well he should. A body of evidence has accumulated over the decades indicating that Hopkins was at least an asset, at least an ally, and quite possibly an agent of the Kremlin. That demands our attention. How Harry Hopkins made his exit, or perhaps made his escape, from the historical record is just the beginning of the mystery. Unlike Major Jordan, for instance, Hopkins was a world-famous figure, the dominant player in the Roosevelt administrations, a mainstream media darling of the day. Harry Hopkins was so big, he wore Winston Churchill's fedora. He was such a White House presence that reporters could tell when he was out of town because the president's appointment list suddenly lengthened. He was so powerful that unelected, unconfirmed, he negotiated one-on-one with Churchill and Stalin. Few men of this century have exerted more influence upon American politics, domestic and foreign, than Hopkins, wrote noted American diplomat Robert Murphy about this man you've never heard of. When Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov made his first visit to Washington in May 1942, Secretary of State Cordell Hull handed Hopkins a memorandum indicating the things he wanted taken up with Molotov. When FDR placed Russia under Lend-Lease through a cable Hopkins drafted in October 1941, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, Hopkins wrote, was obviously unhappy because he is not consulted about the strategy of the war. Harry Hopkins was a one-man cabinet. That's how Life magazine accurately put it in a Hopkins spread that ran on September 22, 1941, just as Lend-Lease was getting into high gear. Being Life magazine, the story includes lots of photos. Harry in a wing chair in the White House Lincoln bedroom, where he lived between May 1940 and December 1943. Harry's childhood home, a frame house with outdoor privy in Grinnell, Iowa. Harry in a robe, recuperating from one of his many, many, many illnesses at the Miami Biltmore Coral Gables. Harry at the racetrack, $2 betting window. Harry in suspenders at the 1940 Chicago Convention, index finger extended at Boss Kelly. Harry in white tie with movie star Errol Flynn and socialite Liz Whitney. Harry with flood victims in Mississippi. Harry with his little girl, Diana, virtually a foster child of Eleanor Roosevelt after the death of Harry's second wife. And Harry's three sons from his first marriage, which ended in divorce. Life explained the star treatment. As boss of the Lend-Lease program, his control of the destiny of empire is second only to Mr. Roosevelt's own. As the president's familiar and constant traveling companion, he is a perfect mirror of executive policy who can make or break a plan or its proponent with as little effort as a grunt or a frown. In the kind of personalized one-man government that war has made of the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt, that man has the greatest influence who has easiest access to the chief of state's ear. Harry Hopkins sees the president early, late, and frequently in between. He is at Roosevelt's bedside before the president goes over to the executive office to begin his grueling business day. And, more often than not, he can be found about 11 o'clock at night in his shabby blue silk dressing gown, sitting on the side of the president's bed discussing tomorrow's problem, just before the bigger and wearier man in the flannel shawl drops off to sleep. What, unimpeded access for an agent of Soviet influence. Not pillow talk, of course, but a uniquely intense and sustained intimacy. Unprecedented for sure. During the 14 days Churchill was in the White House, he and Roosevelt and Hopkins had lunch and dinner together every day but one. Hopkins' official biographer, Robert Sherwood, would write of Arcadia, code name of the first wartime Washington conference of Roosevelt and Churchill that took place following Pearl Harbor in December 1941 to January 1942. It was at the lunches where most of the major problems were thrashed out, and usually to Hopkins' approval. Indeed, in January 1945, when Hopkins would not convince FDR to return Kravchenko to Soviet custody, he could console himself with a remarkable record of successes. In the end, FDR balked on Kravchenko because he couldn't expect a meaningful guarantee from Stalin that on the defector's return, he wouldn't be shot. Hopkins replied to FDR that once Kravchenko was in Soviet custody, no one would know if he had been shot or not. But there the matter lay. I don't think FDR was squeamish. Just as he knew that publicly supporting Free Poland, the casus belli for Britain and France back in 1939, while privately acquiescing to Stalin's installation of a communist puppet government, was good politics in an election year, as FDR himself explained to Stalin at Tehran in December 1943. I think he also knew that returning a defector to a Soviet firing squad was bad politics, especially before the Senate considered ratification of the United Nations agreement. Better to leave the messy matter in limbo. Let Kravchenko take his chances. Certainly that's what happened over more than a year of diplomatic wrangling following the front page walkout. Kravchenko wouldn't gain the right of asylum until the day of FDR's death on April 12th, 1945. Coincidence? As the surviving scraps of this tawdry record reveal, Hopkins spoke of Kravchenko as a deserter, exactly as the Soviets did. He pressed FDR to return Kravchenko to Soviet custody and blew his top when he learned from Joseph, submission to Moscow Davies, that the FBI was trying to recruit Kravchenko as a spy, that Secretary of State Hull knew about it and presumably didn't disapprove. My God, Hopkins exploded. What if Stalin knew that a member of the president's family had been party to this desertion? A queer reaction. Or a queer reaction if the speaker is a devotee of liberty, the rights of man, and the spirit of 76. It makes perfect sense if the speaker is a devotee of Marxism, of statism. Hopkins. Farmers have, for the first time in history, become conscious of their relationship to the government through direct contact with it and help from it, he said in 1939, looking over new crops on the 388-acre Iowa farm he rented in a dead-end presidential probe of his own. Of redistribution, Hopkins. When a democratic victory is won, he wrote in 1941, then the wealth of the world must be shared with all people. And of self-loathing, Hopkins. The days of the policy of the white man's burden are over, he wrote in 1942. Vast masses of people simply are not going to tolerate it. And for the life of me, I can't see why they should. We have left little in our trail except misery and poverty for the people whom we have exploited. 10 days after he penned the above statement in a letter to the U.S. ambassador to Britain, Hopkins followed up with a stem winder before a pro-Russia rally of 20,000 in Madison Square Garden. He said, I believe we are fighting for a new world, because there can be no real freedom without economic freedom. The world can be freed from the economic oppressions that have nourished misery among hundreds of millions of people. There is enough wheat to feed the world. There is enough stone and brick and lumber to house the world. There is enough cotton and wool to clothe the whole human family. But no utopia was ever won without struggle. And the struggle to abolish poverty in the world is a struggle to which every freedom-loving person can wholeheartedly subscribe. Who knew World War II was a war on poverty? Later that same day, Harry would follow his own trail of misery and poverty to swanky El Morocco, zebra-striped and celebrity-studded, where he would sup with Louise Macy, his third wife-to-be, a former Paris editor of Harper's Bazaar. Hopkins and his date took the 1 a.m. train back to Washington, where, the following evening, he felt sufficiently unexploited and unburdened to ask Louise to marry him in the Averill Harriman suite of the Mayflower Hotel before dining at the British Embassy with Winston Churchill. Harry soldiered on, according to the in-depth reportage of a two-part New Yorker profile where these details of his life are preserved. I offer it by way of illustrating Hopkins' personal strategies for coping with his share of the white man's burden. Not that his life was all utopia and nightclubs. There were real aggravations. Kravchenko, for instance. Our source for Hopkins' angry comment on Kravchenko's desertion is Joseph Davies' journal entry of December 22, 1944, via George McJimsey's sympathetic biography of Hopkins. Interestingly enough, December 22, 1944, is also the date of one of the most shocking documents M. Stanton Evans ever fished out of the FBI files. It bears witness to just how close Kravchenko came to American capture, and it's hard not to wonder whether Hopkins was involved. Fortunately for Kravchenko, even before his bestseller I Chose Freedom appeared in 1946, he already carried the small shield of a public profile. He had published several magazine articles and was writing his book with the well-known American journalist Eugene Lyons, our friend from Chapter 4. The Soviets no doubt knew this because one of their agents in the OWI was acting as Kravchenko's translator. More importantly, Kravchenko was cooperating with the FBI and, having entered the country as a civilian, did not, in the eyes of the Attorney General, merit deportation as a military deserter. Still, this FBI memo indicates Kravchenko's arrest was imminent at the hands of unknown U.S. government representatives. Even in the Just the Facts, Ma'am style of the FBI memo, the 1944 warning is quite emphatic. On Friday, December 22nd, Mr. Ugo Carusi, executive assistant to the Attorney General, advised that Mr. Edward Stettinius and the State Department were putting the pressure on the Department of Justice to bring about the surrender of Viktor Kravchenko to the Russians for return to Russia. Mr. Carusi stated that undoubtedly the pressure was also being put on the State Department by the Soviets. Later that afternoon, Mr. Carusi advised that the Attorney General believed the Bureau should discreetly tip off Kravchenko to the fact that the heat was on and that he should flee and carefully hide himself so that he would not be found by government representatives. Stettinius was the new Secretary of State, having just replaced the long-serving and long-out-of-the-loop Cordell Hull. Stettinius would serve 18 months in all, a stint now noted mainly for his relationship with senior aide Alger Hiss as the FBI was closing in on the prized GRU agent. "I hope it isn't you," Stettinius would say to Hiss in April 1945. This period is also notable given Stettinius's relationship to Harry Hopkins. We begin to get the gist from the following cable from Britain's Washington ambassador to the Foreign Office, filched by a Soviet agent in London and passed to Stalin, Molotov, and Beria. Stettinius's appointment to head the State Department was a victory by Harry Hopkins, the cable said. Stettinius is a loyal protege of Hopkins and never forgets it. Since the important strategic posts have been filled by such people as James Forrestal, Harriman, and now Stettinius, the White House, and Hopkins in particular, are getting more complete control than ever. So what else is new? Back in 1941, when Stettinius became the figurehead administrator of Lend-Lease, Robert Sherwood, Hopkins' official biographer, writes, Hopkins knew that policy governing Lend-Lease would still be made in the White House and that the president would continue to delegate most of the responsibility to him. Stettinius was his friend, and they could work together. And that was that. That was always that. It was the Hopkins modus operandi to work through proxies, and this pattern repeats itself throughout his unconstitutional quasi-regency. Such people, as noted by the British ambassador, Forrestal, Harriman, Stettinius, were all Hopkins' picks. In some significant measure, they all owed their administration positions, often their career trajectory, to him. This list goes on, a who's who of the Roosevelt years. Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall, White House Chief of Staff Admiral William D. Leahy, Vice President Henry A. Wallace, and other officials including Charles Bolin, Joseph Davies, General James H. Burns, Donald Nelson. If you were Viktor Kravchenko, the heat really was on. We have to go back to Lend-Lease to begin to understand why the Kravchenko case might have meant as much as it did to Hopkins and the Soviets. Lend-Lease, which Kravchenko could and ultimately did blow the whistle on, was more than the lifeline to the Soviet war effort and beyond. Lend-Lease was also the private bridge to the Kremlin from inside the Roosevelt White House, manned and overseen by Hopkins, most of the time from his White House digs in the Lincoln bedroom. What if, as I asked some pages ago, Lend-Lease, as run out of the Roosevelt White House by Harry Hopkins, was a rogue operation? Certainly, it sailed into law in March 1941 under false colors, sold by FDR to the American public as a means to keep the United States out of war in Europe, as a substitute for U.S. military involvement, not a means by which to enter the war. Supposedly circumventing neutrality laws, but in reality breaking them, Lend-Lease gave the president exclusive power to sell, transfer, lend, or lease such war materiel to Great Britain and China, writes Albert L. Weeks. The legislation endowed the president with unprecedented powers to bypass the Senate and other checks and balances. For example, Lend-Lease allowed FDR to set the terms of the most massive U.S. expenditures in foreign aid in history and their repayment, or non-repayment. Who, then, needed a Senate to advise and consent on related treaties? Who needed treaties? The State Department, too, took on attributes of a governmental fifth wheel, as Hopkins helmed Lend-Lease and U.S. foreign policy from the White House. With the passage of Lend-Lease, Hopkins became identified as Roosevelt's own personal foreign office, Sherwood writes, and more violently controversial than ever. The real-life and official foreign office, a.k.a. the State Department, was in many ways knocked out of power for the duration. It's astonishing to learn, with the exception of interpreters and note-takers, neither Secretary of State Cordell Hull nor any other state officials ever attended any of the wartime conferences with Churchill and Stalin. The British sent Anthony Eden, foreign secretary. The Soviets sent Vyacheslav Molotov, foreign minister. And the Americans sent Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's own personal foreign office. Only at Yalta in February 1945 did the brand new U.S. Secretary of State, Edward Stettinius, attend, Hopkins' loyal protege, ably assisted by top aide Alger Hiss. With the creation of FDR's Map Room, the White House Military Information Center and Communications Office that would morph into the White House Situation Room, the consolidation of powers at the White House was complete. Only the President, Harry Hopkins, and the President's Chief of Staff, Admiral William Leahy, as noted earlier, another Hopkins selection, had access. Churchill, too, when he was in town. Now, all presidential communications with the major wartime allies, Britain, the USSR, and China, entirely bypassed the State Department, which, don't fall out of your chair, in those days included a roster of knowledgeable anti-communist analysts. These anti-communists would be successively purged under direct Soviet pressure in what M. Stanton Evans has referred to as a rolling coup d'etat. The Joint Chiefs, too, were often kept in the dark until the die was cast, said Major General John R. Dean, former secretary to the Joint Chiefs, who would become the Moscow-based administrator of Lend-Lease and write an important book about the experience called The Strange Alliance. Lend-Lease did more than transform the power structure of the U.S. government. It also introduced a revolutionary principle into our foreign policy. I'll just put it out there in the words of Junior Stettinius, the Hopkins protege whom we just saw putting the heat on Kravchenko in 1944, or at least conducting it, since Stettinius was, by all accounts, the emptiest of well-tailored suits. As Stettinius wrote, or perhaps better, in words attributed to Stettinius, the principle was contained in the words defining eligibility for Lend-Lease aid. Any country whose defense the president deems vital to the defense of the United States. The word vital was the heart of the matter. To favor limited aid to the Allies as an expedient device for saving friendly nations from conquest was one thing. To declare that the defense of those nations was vital to our own national security was quite another. If we adopted the bill with those words, we would, in effect, declare the interdependence of the American people with the other freedom-loving nations of the world in the face of Axis aggression. We did, indeed, adopt the Lend-Lease bill with those words. This makes March 11, 1941, the day the Lend-Lease bill passed after 3 months of raucous congressional debate, America's Interdependence Day. It was the first day of a new global order under which all manner of international intervention is automatically declared vital, in other words, essential to life, to U.S. interests. It no longer even draws comment when American presidents routinely declare the destinies of far-flung peoples vital to that of the United States, whether it is Saudi Arabia, Roosevelt, Iraq, Bush, or Afghanistan, Obama. So how did Lend-Lease, this de facto American declaration of global interdependence, this de facto reversal of non-belligerence, if not also this de facto declaration of war, come about? Notably, the dispensers of conventional wisdom draw a stunning blank on its origins. Roosevelt biographer Doris Kearns Goodwin's explanation is typical. How Roosevelt arrived at this ingenious idea, which cut through all the stale debates in Washington about loans and gifts, is unclear. She writes, in her 1995 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, No Ordinary Time. Goodwin goes on to quote Robert Sherwood, who, citing Harry Hopkins, described Roosevelt's unseen, supposedly creative mode by which policy was hatched, a mysterious refueling process, as Sherwood described it. Then one evening, Hopkins told Sherwood, recalling a two-week post-election fishing trip he accompanied FDR on in December 1940. He suddenly came out with it, Lend-Lease, the whole program. Sounds like a fish story, but Sherwood happily took the bait from Hopkins' hook. One can only say that Roosevelt, a creative artist in politics, had put in his time on this cruise, evolving the pattern of a masterpiece. Then again, according to Labor Secretary Frances Perkins, the masterpiece didn't take any time at all. She wrote that Lend-Lease was a flash of almost clairvoyant knowledge and understanding, describing FDR's quasi-divine policy revelation as being akin to when a musical genius suddenly perceives the structure of an entire symphony or opera. In fact, the evidence suggests Lend-Lease was a con job and a really big one, put over by another Soviet tool, Soviet go-between, Soviet money launderer, Soviet hobnobber, Armand Hammer. So reports Edward J. Epstein, who, in his groundbreaking 1996 biography of Hammer, assembled a convincing record indicating that Hammer was the person who floated the original Lend-Lease notion back in 1940. As Epstein discovered, Hammer had transformed himself virtually overnight from a businessman specializing in importing art and barrel staves from Stalin's Russia to a geopolitical strategist concerned with helping Great Britain get immediate aid from the United States. Before Dossier, incidentally, Epstein's Hammer biography, which establishes Hammer as a traitor with revelations of Hammer's pro-Soviet activities, the international businessman was generally billed as a nice old philanthropic man of peace. That quick transformation of Hammer's back in 1940 is odd on its face, given that Hammer had Soviet interests at heart and in the bank. Why would he start beating the drum, taking out newspaper ads urging British aid, contributing money to pro-British funds for Britain? Meanwhile, given the only marginal profitability of Hammer's businesses at that time, Epstein notes, it was not clear where he was getting the funds for his campaign. While Hammer wrote of his concerns as a Jew regarding Nazi Germany, Epstein notes Hammer was simultaneously helping to facilitate oil trade into Germany, scoring a 10 on the hypocrisy meter. The fact is, helping Britain at this early stage in hostilities helped the Kremlin and was, in fact, the Communist Party line du jour. The longer the British pursued the war against Hitler, Epstein explains, the more time Stalin would have to prepare the Red Army for what he considered to be an inevitable war with Hitler. After all, they had read Hitler's plans for them in Mein Kampf and even had plans of their own. Epstein tells us Hammer not only launched a PR campaign on Britain's behalf, but also lobbied the British Embassy in Washington with an idea that resembled the initial Lend-Lease policy, under which the United States lent destroyers for the lease of British bases, which famously eliminated the need for money to procure aid. The British were cool to Hammer's query, already having established that he was part of the Soviet secret regime in the West. Too bad they didn't mention that to us. Then again, maybe they did, and the intelligence somehow found its way to that nice, quiet, bureaucratic dead end where all too much anti-Soviet intelligence disappeared. Undeterred, Hammer tried the U.S. Senate, where he convinced a friendly Senator William H. King, Democrat of Utah, to present, unsuccessfully, aid legislation that Hammer himself had drafted in September 1940. Finally, Hammer briefly met with FDR himself at the White House on November 28, 1940. Epstein calls this meeting the 5-Minute Summit. It seems to have done the trick. FDR and Hopkins embarked on that post-election 2-week refueling cruise in December, which Sherwood mentioned above, immediately after which FDR announced the plan for Lend-Lease in a press conference. He followed up in a fireside chat with the Hopkins-crafted declaration that the United States must now become the arsenal for democracy. Epstein further notes that FDR dispatched Deputy President Hopkins to New York City at least 2 times to confer with Hammer further on this aid idea. Like a cuckoo's egg, then, Lend-Lease was laid inside the White House nest by Hammer, the Soviet tool, where Stalin's best friend Hopkins had only to keep it in place so the president could hatch and crow about it. Still, there were details to work out. Who better to work them out than Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, Harry Dexter White? Albert Weeks tells us that White was one of the main drafters of the administration side of the Lend-Lease particulars, especially as Lend-Lease was to be extended to the Russians. Harry Dexter White was also signed, sealed, and delivered by copious documentation, a Soviet spy. From Hammer to Hopkins to White, and back again to Hopkins, the question now becomes, how could Lend-Lease not have been a rogue operation? In short, Lend-Lease was a slam-dunk victorious Soviet influence operation carried out and executed by Uncle Sucker.